George Eliot's Middlemarch is considered one of the greatest English novels. It deals with the complexity of love, the meaning of marriage, morality, and human aspiration and failure. Virginia Woolf said that Middlemarch was one of the few English novels written for grown-up people, and it's our March Book Club selection. Rebecca Mead joins us to talk about Middlemarch and about her own book, My Life in Middlemarch, which looks at the important place the novel has in her own life. It's published by Crown. I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show.
I'm very happy to be here.
And we invite our listeners to join the conversation. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or join us on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. So let's talk about that Virginia Woolf comment that Middlemarch is one of the few English novels written for grown-up people. What do you think made her see it that way?
I think what she was talking about is the way that Middlemarch doesn't have a happy ending, really. I mean, it has many endings for its different characters, but none of them is sort of neatly tied up in a bow. And so there are stories in the novel of failure and of disappointment, or of not even complete failure or disappointment, but just living an ordinary, you know, moderately achieving life. And so I think that it feels very real because it's not a fantasy. It's an absolutely, it feels like absolutely true to life.
How old were you when you first read it?
I was not a grown-up person, although I thought I was. I was 17 years old, and I was studying to take the entrance exams to go to university.
Yes. So you were reading it because you had to?
I wasn't quite reading it because I had to. I mean, it was one of the texts that I was going to be tested on, so yes. But I also very much wanted to read it. I mean, I knew that Virginia Woolf had said this about it, or that, you know, that lots of people thought that it was the most important novel in the English language, and I aspired to be one of the people that understood why.
A number of our listeners have written in already to tell us that it's one of those books that they have read throughout their lives, because each time they read it, they get something different.
Yeah, and that's what my book is really about, that kind of journey over, you know, now 30 years with Middlemarch and reading it at different stages of my life and how it has changed and evolved. And every time I go back to it, it has something new to tell me.
And do you see yourself in the book in any way?
I do, although where I see myself changes. I mean, when I first read it when I was 17, I very strongly identified with that character of Dorothea Brooke, who is the young woman at the beginning of her life, wanting to have a more significant life than the one she seems to be born into. And I grew up in a provincial town in England and was desperately yearning to have a more significant life than the one that I saw around me. And so that character spoke very clearly to me then.
When we meet her at the beginning of the novel, she's marrying Edward Casaubon, who no one else thinks is a good match for her. What does she see in him?
Well, she sees him as a way to broaden her own intellectual horizons, really. She wants to help him in what she thinks is his great work. And although everybody around her and the reader, too, can tell that he is not all he seems to be to her, I find her kind of longing for something more than just marrying the baronet next door, who's the man who wants to marry her, and everybody else thinks that she should marry. I find her aspiration really admirable, actually.
Well, he is someone who is educated. Is she confusing education, academic ability with wisdom?
Well, she is, yes. I mean, and he is somebody who has read a great deal, but crucially knows himself very little, which is where the sort of tragedy of their marriage begins. He thinks that he saved himself for all these years for marriage, and then discovers that once he's betrothed to her, he can't quite access the feelings that he hopes he's going to be able to.
Will Ladislaw, Casaubon's young cousin, says if he chose to grow gray crunching bones in a cavern, he had no business to bring a living girl into his companionship. And Amy's feelings of Casaubon, her feelings of passion and excitement at the time of their engagement fade even before the wedding. Dorothea is disenchanted before the end of the the honeymoon. I mean, do they think that they've made a big mistake?
I think that they both know that they've made a big mistake as soon as they're married. I mean, the honeymoon in Rome is so dreadful. And of course, George Eliot can't write explicitly about what goes on in that honeymoon suite, but you can tell it's pretty awful from the way that Dorothea's walking around Rome in this state of sort of confused agitation, emotional agitation, and Casaubon is stiffly turning away from her and won't let her touch him. I mean, it's excruciating to read.
You could say similar things about Lydgate. He really doesn't understand women at all.
He doesn't. I mean, Lydgate is the doctor, young doctor, who comes into town and has this desire to make great steps forward in medical research, and then is sort of fatally undermined by, what undermines him is marrying Rosamund Vincey, who is the town beauty. He's a remarkably intelligent man, but his intelligence doesn't extend to having much of an understanding about the complexity of women.
Well, Middlemarch is sort of the opposite of the traditional marriage plot we find in Jane Austen novels, for example. This book starts with a marriage, then examines how people live with each other. Jane Austen is a very great writer, but this is something that we all can understand as well. And I was wondering whether Eliot was thinking about Austen when she wrote her novel.
I think she was, yes. I mean, she admired Jane Austen a great deal. And in fact, before she wrote her first work of fiction, Scenes of Clerical Life, she reread all of Jane Austen to sort of psych herself up and get herself ready. And I think that the beginning of Middlemarch, where we have these two sisters who are both unmarried and about to embark upon their lives, has a very Austenian tone. There's a kind of Austenian lightness and irony even in their relationship between each other. But as you say, Dorothea gets married very early in the book. She makes that error very early in the book, and then the rest of the book is concerned in many ways with the unfolding of that.
Well, it's something that would have been a real problem for a woman at that time to have to think of getting out of a marriage, although in the case of Eliot, she never did marry the man she lived with for many years.
She didn't, no, but she would have done if she could have done. I mean, he was married, George Henry Lewes was married to somebody else, and they had separated, and he and George Eliot fell in love when they were both in their early 30s, and they decided to do the thing that Victorians didn't do, which was move in together and live as husband and wife. But I think if they could have married, they would have married.
Well, Dickens did the same thing late in his life. So maybe this was the Victorian answer to an unhappy marriage.
There were lots of Victorian answers to unhappy marriages, but the thing that you sort of couldn't do, especially if you were a woman, was to just go and live with somebody as if you were married. And George Eliot paid a very high social price for it, although, you know, not being invited to dinner at people's houses did give her an opportunity to stay home and read and write.
Now, she used the nom de plume George Eliot, but people knew who she was, didn't they, when this book was published?
Yeah, by the time Middlemarch was published, people knew who she was. She used the nom de plume initially partly because she was a scandalous woman, because she was living with Lewes, and had she published her first fiction under her own name, it would have been read in the light of her as an adulteress. But by the time Middlemarch came out, in fact, by the time her first full novel, Adam Bede, came out, she had put up her hand and said, it's me. And so people did know that it was her.
Middlemarch is about morality, but without being preachy. What moral questions is she examining here?
You know, George Eliot was a religious woman in her youth. She was very, very devout. And she lost her faith in her 20s. But she didn't just lose it. She didn't just grow out of it. I mean, she thought her way out of it very, very hard by reading and talking and thinking. And yet she always retained this very strong, the moral underpinnings of her Christian faith, which was how to be good to other people. And so what she's concerned with in Middlemarch is, you know, how do you go about being good in the absence of God, I think.
And you say the theme of Middlemarch is growing out of a kind of self-centeredness.
Yeah, it's about, I mean, sympathy is a very, very important word for her in this novel and in all her work. And sympathy means entering into the feelings and wishes of another person, really understanding the difference between another person and yourself, even if that other person may be very close to you. There's always a slightly different center of self, a different center of gravity. And that was what she sought to encourage through the way that the book is constructed and the themes of the book. It was very, very important to her.
George Eliot called Middlemarch a study of provincial life. It's set in England in the 1830s in the provinces. Was it modeled on any real town?
Well, it's not modeled exactly on a real town in the way that, you know, Thomas Hardy's novels are set in real places. But Middlemarch draws upon Coventry, which is the city that George Eliot lived in from her 20s to until she was about 30. And so there are lots of similarities between Middlemarch and Coventry. It's a you know, industrial textile-making town.
Well, she must have thought a lot about what to name that town. What is the significance of Middlemarch?
Yeah, Middlemarch. I mean, you know, there are lots of towns in England that have middle as their first, the first part of the name. There's Middleborough and Middleton. But there's no Middlemarch. And there aren't, in fact, there aren't any towns that end with March. I think that it's what it suggests is this kind of absolute middlingness of Middle England, you know, the kind of ordinary pedestrian lives of most people.
Monica from Chappaqua left this question on our show page. She wrote, "Thank you, thank you. I have read Middlemarch twice, and each time the takeaway is a greater helping for me in my life's journey. Do you think that had Eliot written this book under her real name, that it would have had the critical acclaim that it has received?"
I mean, I think it would have done, although, as I say, her name was a complicated name. And in fact, what she called herself was Marion Lewis, although that wasn't her legal name. So some scholars have argued that she used the name Middlemarch because she used the name George Eliot because she didn't really know what she was called. But I think, you know, we know that she's a woman. We know that she's, a very wise person. I'm sure it would be received just as significantly.
A caller wonders if George Eliot had read Anna Karenina. Do we know what books she admired?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. That's a very good question. Can't tell you.
Well, you almost have to wonder whether Flaubert had read Middlemarch.
I'm sure that's the case.
How was it received when it was published?
It was received with very great excitement. It was published serially over about 13 months and in 8 volumes. And the volumes were reviewed serially too. So people were anticipating what was going to happen next. And you can go back and read what the reviewers said and what they thought, you know, was Dorothea going to marry Lydgate? And, you know, there was a lot of excitement and anticipation.
Well, often when books are published serially and written serially, in fact, you're still writing it while part of it has been published, it leads to a certain amount of sloppiness. But I don't get that feeling here.
No, you don't get the sense that George Eliot was sort of crowdsourcing Middlemarch and deciding, you know, who was going to marry whom on the basis of what fan letters she received. I mean, she knew what she was doing. She knew where she was going. There's a wonderful story of her, of an acquaintance of her running into her in the street in London and sort of lamenting the what was going on with Lydgate and how awful his marriage was. And George Eliot sort of nodding and saying, well, you know, it has to go that way for my resolution of my story.
And you read the original manuscript?
I did get to look at the original manuscript in the British Library.
There's a lot of crossings out?
You know, there are some, but there's not as many as you might think. And her handwriting's very neat. but there are some, yes. It was very, very thrilling to be in touch with the actual paper that she'd written it upon.
I'm speaking with Rebecca Mead, who's written her own book about Middlemarch called My Life in Middlemarch. And Marshall from Carlstadt, New Jersey, wrote this. He said, "I read your book cover to cover over the weekend, and as a male reader, I especially liked what you said at the top of page 171. Who is to say that a middle-aged man, given the free space for imaginative sympathy that a great work of literature provides, might not identify with a naive young woman within its pages?" And then he says, "I've read Middlemarch twice, first as a student in college, again after a 25-year interval, and both times I found it to be poignant and personally illuminating."
Oh, thank you, Marshall. I mean, I think that's a wonderful testament to the way that a great work of fiction allows access to a reader who may not identify with a character in the book because the character is like them. Female reader may not need to identify with a female character or anything like that. That there's such there's such sympathy and such acuity in the description of these characters in the book that we have access as readers to many, many people in many different points.
Well, often when we face a book written by a woman, less a man, we are asked whether it has an obvious female point of view. Do you think this one does?
Yeah, there is. That is always the question. And I don't,
I don't see it in Edith Wharton, for example, yeah. But I do in Virginia Woolf.
Yeah. No, it's a good question. And I wonder if there's a way in which just the fact that George Eliot has a masculine pseudonym that we still continue to use gives her a kind of ambiguity of gender as an author. I think it does, in a way. It's very much not a woman's book. Middlemarch, not only does it feature a lot of male characters just as significantly as the female ones, but it's about everybody's life. It's not just about the story of a young woman on her way to marriage or something like that.
Again, a reminder that if you want to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC, or you can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. You not only read the manuscript, but you also handled some of her belongings.
I did.
Why was that significant to you?
Well, I went to the home of one of the descendants of George Henry Lewes, who still owns some of the possessions that had been George Eliot's. I was having dinner at his house, and he pointed out some things on the mantelpiece, and among them, George Eliot's pen. So I got to pick up this pen and hold this pen. It's made from bone, very heavy in the hand. And there's something, very exciting about touching the pen that might have written Middlemarch, or at the very least wrote some of her letters, But she writes about writing with a pen and the kind of effort that it took, holding this pen in your hand with a tired nib, she writes. And you think about what the actual production of a novel in those days was. You were writing, actually having to hand write it all out instead of just typing it into the ether.
Well, some people continued to write things out by hand. In fact, John Updike used to talk about writing everything in pen.
Yeah.
But it is true that many people see a difference in the way things even read today because we've moved from the typewriter to the computer.
Yeah, and I think that when you were writing manuscript pages, you sort of wanted to use them. I mean, she writes about, I have 40 good pages, and she wants to use those 40 pages in a book somewhere.
Steve Sears from Bloomfield, New Jersey, left this comment about your book. He said, "Wonderful book. How long did it take to write it from conception to final draft? And what was most fun, hearkening back to Eliot's days and retracing her steps and, in some spots, yours, or detailing Middlemarch for readers? What was most invigorating?"
The book from conception to writing was about 3 years, but the actual writing was very, very quick. It was about 5 months, and I wrote it in a sort of joyful flood of energy. It was a really wonderful experience. And I think that what was most meaningful for me about doing this project, it was very wonderful to go back to these places that George Eliot had lived and to read the books and to read her letters and all of those things. But the way in which doing that gave me the opportunity to think about my own life, about my own childhood, about my relationship to my parents, to my own child, to my husband, but all those things that really matter about, where you've come from and where you are and where you're going. That's what reading Middlemarch gave me.
Well, we've been talking about how men react to this, and it's interesting that most of the comments we've received have been from men, actually, who love Middlemarch. David left this comment: "Without Middlemarch, there would be no Henry James, Joseph Conrad, Marcel Proust, or William Faulkner. Do you see her influence on other writers, and in what ways?"
Oh, I mean, there's barely a novelist working, isn't there, who at least working in the sort of realist mode, who doesn't credit George Eliot and in some way. I mean, it's impossible to imagine the fiction of the last 150 years without her.
And then Will on Twitter says, "I memorize it is an uneasy lot at best to be what we call highly taught and yet not to enjoy."
Oh, you're sending chills down my spine.
He wonders
so
if you have any favorite lines.
Oh, I mean, I have many, but the line that I think of often is the beautiful line about marriage being the home epic. This wonderful description of the kind of enormous accomplishment of marriage, but also the small domesticity of it. And I think that that's one of the things that Middlemarch is about.
Well, there's another marriage in the book between Mary Garth and Fred Vincy, and they don't rush into it. Why is their marriage better than Dorothy and Casaubon's and Rosamund and Lydgate's? And was Eliot's marriage, her real marriage after, was that a happy marriage?
She was married very briefly to a man called John Cross, who had been her and Lewis's financial advisor, and they were married for only about 7 months before she died. I think that it's hard to know what that marriage would have become, but she certainly seems to have been, from her letters, very much in love, and very much, it mattered very much to her to have a companion in her life and somebody to care about in her life after having suffered the loss of her really beloved, you know, the great love of her life, Lewis.
Didn't Henry James have a lot to say about George Eliot?
He had a lot to say about her.
Was he always complimentary?
He was not, although he also was. But, I mean, he talked about, you know, famously describing her appearance as, you know, a great horse-faced blue stocking, although he also said that he fell in love with her. I think that she had a kind of radiant intelligence that overcame any kind of plainness of her features. He wrote a lot about her books, too, and many essays. And I think that, you know, when you read his essays, you're seeing him, the novelist, trying to figure out what he wants to do differently. He calls, you know, Middlemarch a treasure house of details, but an indifferent whole, which is not my read of it.
Now, this is her great book. She did write other books, but none of them come close.
No, they don't quite. I mean, I Daniel Deronda, her last novel, is magnificent. And, you know, anybody who's loved Middlemarch and hasn't read that, I strongly recommend it. You know, The Mill on the Floss is a beautiful book about an unhappy childhood, really. But Middlemarch has a kind of, you know, finished and complete feeling to it that some of the other novels don't have. She was incredibly ambitious, and so sometimes her ambitions weren't fully fulfilled. But Middlemarch is the most polished and the most accomplished of them.
You think because she creates a complete world here?
She creates a complete world, and we enter into it as readers. I mean, she makes Middlemarchers of us all.
Now, you did a lot of research, obviously, and that's all included in your book, My Life in Middlemarch. Do you think it matters whether we know much about the person who created the work that we love?
I don't think it necessarily does, no. I mean, you know, I think that we can read books and not want to know about the author because we just love the book in itself. You know, I wanted to go back and explore her life and to understand what had generated Middlemarch, you know, what influences upon her there might have been, in order to kind of understand my own reading of it better. But I don't think one needs to know the life of an author, although she had an incredibly interesting life and it's one well worth knowing about.
Well, did knowing more about her change how you read her novels?
It does, yes. I mean, you know, for example, I didn't know or I hadn't really thought much about the fact that she gained three stepsons through her relationship with Lewis. And, you know, these three boys who were adolescents when she was, you know, in the first years of her relationship with Lewis, and one of them died at the age of 25 while she was writing Middlemarch. I think that the kind of struggles and searchings of young men to try to figure out what they're going to do with their lives is something that greatly informs Middlemarch. And when I read Middlemarch, I see that story embedded, knitted in, not told explicitly, but I think it's very much part of what was going on with her.
Didn't she have another version for the last line than the one she ended up using?
She did, and which I discovered I hadn't known. I'm sure scholars knew this, but I didn't know. I was reading the manuscript in the British Library and looking forward to that magnificent last line of the book and read it and saw that it wasn't quite the same and actually wasn't quite as good. So, yes, she did revise it. You can imagine her sort of getting to the end of the manuscript with a kind of sense of exhaustion and exhilaration that one has finishing something and then going back the next day and thinking, I can make this a little bit better.
Well, we've had people read from their works, and I've watched sometimes that they actually change words because in retrospect, they realize they would have preferred to have phrased something a little differently.
Yeah, I think that happens with all writers.
You are a staff writer for The New Yorker. You did this on your spare time?
I took a leave of absence. They're very generous.
And the critics have been very generous as well, because this book is quite wonderful, My Life in Middlemarch, by Rebecca Mead and published by Crown. It has been the subject of this month's Leonard Lopate Show book club, and I don't know whether we can ever top this on the book club. I mean, this is... where do we go from here? Proust?
You could try Proust.
There isn't much more, is there?
No, I mean, Middlemarch is a pinnacle. I'm glad we've all reached it together.
And thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.